You're listening to Atheistically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Atheistically Speaking. This is episode 177. I'm your host, Thomas Smith. All right, well, I've got a great discussion for you guys this week. Really excited about it. It was fascinating. I like when I get to talk to somebody who really disagrees with me. It's fun. But before that, I need to talk about a couple things. First, there's the shooting. There's a lot of stuff that's been going on with that I would love to talk about, but due to schedule, I'm not going to be able to until next week. I think next week I may end up doing some stuff. And don't worry, it's not going to be the same old, same old. There's a lot of stuff to talk about with current events. And I haven't done a current events kind of show in a while, so I think maybe we're due. And I like when I get to hear from you guys, your opinions on that and stuff. So. And then secondly, I need to say there's been a Patreon hack. I don't know. I think likely my patrons have gotten emailed about it. I know I got emailed by Patreon. Okay. So I want to say a few things about that. First off, back when this Ashley Madison thing happened, I was never one of these idiots who was saying like, well, I deserve it because they're doing it. It's like, no, I don't. We need to have a rule of law, and we need to have we need to be able to conduct business in a way online that is protected from essentially thieves. It is thieves, not even essentially. We need to be able to conduct commerce, whatever it is, as long as it's legal. I understand you don't want to be able to conduct, like, I don't know, terrorism or arms trade or something, but assuming it's legal, which for now, anything, Patreon, adultery, it's all legal. We need to be able to practice that. No matter if you disagree with what that is or not, if it's legal, it needs to be protected by the law, and it needs to be protected from thieves. And in this case, just awful, no good thieves. I can't tell you how mad I am about this hack, because I think Patreon is a great website. They've been really cool. They're a great company. They've been very transparent. They've kept their promise of keeping their fee the same. You know, people have suggested they could increase it, but they've kept it the same. There's a lot of good things about Patreon. And most importantly, it's a place where people like you can support something that you like maybe this show for some of you, which is awesome. And I just can't believe these hackers. I don't know what kind of people do this. I really don't. I mean, I hate hackers. I just have to say, I freaking hate hackers. I don't mind. It's one thing if you're, I can hear it already. It's if you're a white hat hacker and you're just trying to help people out, you're obviously amazing. I think that's like the polar opposite. That's really cool. If you hack a site like Patreon.com just to post the stuff, like, you know, it seems like whoever breaches the data doesn't even do anything with it. They just post it online and then other people do stuff with it. I don't get. Again, a site like Patreon, what do they do to anybody? It's a great place where people can go support work they like, and it's been hacked. Well, I want to tell you that I've talked to Bangs Naughty Bits, who's my resident IT expert. I know he'll probably blush at that, but I trust him on a lot of things. I've looked over the articles and stuff. It looks as though all your credit card information is totally safe. So don't worry about Patreon in terms of your credit cards being violated. I'll let you know the minute I hear differently. But from what Bangs has looked at the data published, credit card numbers is not included. So that should be totally fine. Also, the data is what Patreon told me, and I'm guessing all of you who sign on to Patreon, is that it was encrypted data. Well, I mean, that might have been a little misleading, or at least maybe Patreon was being probably a little optimistic, because I'm guessing they'll be able to crack whatever encryption that is. And also, if you go to there's a website called let me get the precise URL. It's haveibeenpwned.com, obviously P-W-N-E-D. And that actually, you can just put in your email and then it hacks you and steals all your money. So it's a good, no, you put in your email and it'll tell you if you've been involved in one of these hacks. And I put in mine and said, yes, you've been involved in the Patreon hack. So what I really need to recommend for all my lovely supporters, again, I feel so bad about this. Like, it's just such an awful thing. I don't get it. I don't get what the point of it is. But I'd recommend changing your passwords. I'd highly recommend changing your passwords. I'm actually going to go through and change all my passwords to everything just because I'm worried that I had so many emails. Because I have like, three, four different Patreon accounts and different emails and all that. I'm just going to change everything. I think also it might be that creators, if there's any creators out there on Patreon listening, I think our information was actually hacked worse because our information sits on the server, whereas the credit card information of the patrons, that doesn't actually sit on the server. So we might actually have it worse. So I'm not worried about that. I'm really worried about you guys and your ability to pledge to something you like and want to support, even if it's not me, even if it's anybody. It's mind blowing. I don't know why anyone would want to take that away from people, but it's totally fine. Like, it's seriously, I don't want anyone to overreact. It seems as though it's going to be okay. They say the breach is obviously. One more thing. The data starts on, it ends rather on September 25th or 26th. So if anyone joined Patreon after that, you're actually totally fine. So the data was hacked a long time ago and then they earned, well, not a long time ago. Sorry, a week or two ago. And I know I've had some new patrons since then. So you're in luck. You're totally fine. Unless, of course, you're already on Patreon pledging someone else. But anyway, so that's all I want to say. Just I highly recommend changing your password. But I don't think it's more serious than that. Unless, like I say, you're a creator like I am. And I'll see about it. But these days, there's so much fraud protection on everything. I'm actually not worried. Oftentimes, I'll try to make a purchase and my own bank will deny it and like call me about it. So, I mean, I'm not particularly worried, but again, I'm going to change my passwords as a precaution. So there you have it. Sorry for that long message, but I just feel so bad about this and it's so frustrating. But with that, I want to bring you the content that my lovely Patreons at patreon.com/atheist pledge for, and that is, I think, a really good discussion between me and Tyler Vella, someone who is a Christian and disagrees with the way I interpret the Bible, and my other podcast, Thomas and the Bible. So I thought it was really fascinating. Let's get to part one of that discussion, and I hope you enjoy it. Joining me right now is Tyler Vella. Did I pronounce that right?
You did.
All right. Perfect. Okay. Well, I'm done. My work here is done. I'm out.
That's it. Peace out.
Yeah. And, well, I don't know how to introduce this. I guess you're Christian, I assume, right?
Yes, I am.
Any specific denomination that we should know about? Or
I mean, I belong to the PCA, which is the Presbyterian Church in America, but I'm just broadly Reformed. In my theology.
Okay. You had some criticism about how I've been reading the Bible, or probably more broadly how a lot of people might read the Bible, I assume. I'm not 100% sure the extent of your criticism, so I think I'm going to go ahead and let you go. I like that you, I think you listen to the show from time to time, right?
I do. Well, I listen to, cool. And actually, I mean, my comments were not that much of a criticism of this show, but of course, other one.
Right. Yeah. And yeah. I think everyone should know, but in case they don't, I have a podcast, Thomas and the Bible, where I'm reading through the entire Bible. And it's eaten up 5-6 years of my life. One of my biggest regrets, but there you go. No.
Don't you have one of those, like, through the Bible in a year? Just follow one of those.
Well, that's what I was trying to do, actually. And then it just is so much, it's hard to do it every day. So I did it, I switched it to like a once a week, which of course makes it 5 years because, you know, yeah, 5 business days. But anyway. So why don't you go ahead? I really appreciate you coming on. I really like having people who have different opinions on the show. I like that a lot. So I'm glad that you listen despite being, you know, Christian. I'm glad you, are open-minded enough to listen to my show, and I'm happy to hear what you have to say.
Yeah, I actually, in people have asked me, because I've been, you know, saying I'm coming on the show, I'm going to talk about hermeneutics. And they're like, oh, you're going on an atheist show. And I'm like, yeah, it's actually a really good show. You guys should listen to it.
Oh, thanks. I appreciate that.
Yeah. I mean, I recommend a show. You had my friend Elijah on.
I love Elijah.
A couple months ago.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you guys know each other personally or just like online?
Online. We've known each other for a couple of years online. We have the same birthday, which helps.
Yeah, that's always a good answer.
So,
just wondering. I wasn't sure if it was a close personal physical friendship or an online one. Not to take away from it or anything. I was just wondering.
It's a dear, dear friend.
Nice.
We go way back to September 13th when we were born. no, so yeah, I mean, so like I said, it's not a criticism for this show, actually. This show I recommend because you tend to, and not to overly flatter you or anything, you tend to be pretty objective. I appreciate that you can kind of call out atheist the kind of some of the depths of the rhetoric that parts of the movement have gone to, and you're able to do that, and so I appreciate it. It's the other show that I have some of my criticisms, and it's not actually, like you hinted at, it's not you. It's more just the way that a lot of people read the Bible. So this isn't even really a criticism just of atheists either. So a lot of this comes down to a lot of my criticisms for how some of my fellow Christians read it. So if you go to kind of your average, you know, Southern Baptist fundamentalist church, I'm going to have a lot of these exact same criticisms. And so I think part of the problem when you get into some of these interfaith dialogues or dialogues between Christians and atheists is that a lot of atheists just come out of those traditions, and so they don't know any better. And so they just kind of have that fundamentalist interpretive hangover when they become atheists. And so they read it that way. And then you kind of get this, and I don't know if this is your case or anything like that, but you kind of get this feedback loop where that's their initial hermeneutic. But then because they don't believe it, or they think it's false, or they think it's nonsense or whatever, then it causes them to study it even less, which then kind of reinforces that kind of ignorance or that type of hyper-literal interpretation, which makes it come across as even more stupid, which makes them think it's even more nonsense, and just kind of down and down it goes, kind of in that downward feedback loop. That was kind of one of my criticisms for you. I don't know how much you want me to hijack your show to talk about
it. I want to definitely let you talk as much as you want. Why don't you go ahead and just to square one it here, can you explain to me what do you mean by hermeneutics? I know, but just to make sure everybody's on the same page.
Yeah. So, well, that's a good question, because not everyone's on the same page what I found, because a lot of times when you're going in, especially coming out of these fundamentalist churches, is that hermeneutics just means they use it much more like harmonization, where hermeneutics is, well, we need to read it to make it true. So for a lot of times, hermeneutics for these fundamentalist Christians is actually a way of doing theology. And so when an atheist, that's all they know of the term. When they hear hermeneutics, that's what they think. But now for them, it has a negative connotation. When really hermeneutics is just, without going, I mean, hermeneutics in kind of the literary sense, not in the, you know, kind of crazy continental philosophical, you know, hermeneutics type of sense. But hermeneutics is just how do you read and interpret any piece of literature, right? It's not just
so it's
the
kind
Bible.
Of a, and that's something I did learn. I can't remember when, but I know what you mean. I think you have a valid point that atheists hear it and think like, oh, that's just some, you know, BS theology thing. But I suppose I think it's more of a neutral term.
Yeah.
It's just weird that you don't come across it much except for when reading the Bible. And I don't know what that means. I know I've gone through my whole life. I've gone through college. I've gone through, I'm pretty well educated. Had never heard the term. I mean, wasn't a literature major or anything like that, an English lit major or anything, but it's interesting that it seems to be pretty exclusively for the Bible in common parlance.
Yeah, I think that just has to do with there's so much more literature and there's so much more intentionality on the Bible for just interpretive pedagogy. You know, we don't have long extended debates and read thousands of books and such on, you know, how to read and interpret I don't know, any other, you know.
Yeah, I know, I have my theories as to why that is, but I'm sure we would disagree.
we might. But I mean, ultimately, hermeneutics is really just reading a text well. I mean, it's like the same way if you're really only going to hear the terms exegesis and eisegesis when you're talking about biblical studies. But really, exegesis is just the proper translation of one language into another language. Right. Mm. Within a text. So even though that the term exegesis is almost exclusively used to talk about translation of biblical languages, really what's meant by it is just, you know, are you exegeting? Are you drawing out the text from the text itself, or are you imposing kind of our late modern Western views onto it, which would be eisegesis? So hermeneutics is a lot like that, where it gets a lot of play because it's really important in biblical studies, whereas in other studies you just kind of do it. You don't have a lot of attention given to it. It's just you just do it. We oftentimes just talk about reading comprehension or something like that.
Right, right.
But really, good reading comprehension just is good hermeneutics.
Okay, so let me, I guess, not really respond, but kind of address some of the things you've said. I don't come from a fundamentalist background. I know, and I know you weren't directing that at me. You're kind of talking in general, and that's totally fine. But just to let you know, that's not my situation. I came right. from a pretty lax Christianity. Just my mom made me go to church until I was in high school, and then she didn't want to make me do it anymore. So definitely, I think there are more people than we tend to give credit to who believe in certain – and more Christians, that is, who believe in certain parts of the Bible very literally. And I think that sometimes people in your position, or people I hear who have the same critiques that you have, are critiquing as though no one – as though atheists read the Bible literally and not many Christians do. But I think there's a lot of Christians who – I would say most Christians believe in a literal Adam and Eve. Most of them believe in a Noah's Ark story, which is insane. Like, I know that when you talk to the smartest Christians, they tend to say, well, yeah, it's probably, you know, just, what, it's probably metaphor. That didn't really happen. But I don't know. Most Christians I've talked to and the ones I was raised with believe that literally happened. So
right.
It's an interesting thing to talk about when you're talking about literal interpretation versus not. But anyway, I didn't grow up – I grew up not really reading the Bible at all. I mean, I kind of read – I had a little bit of New Testament taught to me. But I would say in terms of the influences on my hermeneutic, as you might say, there's not much there. My whole goal in reading the Bible – and maybe you'll object to this even just as a goal, but my kind of – approach was that I was going to take it as someone who just – I live in the time that I live in. I am a reasonably well-educated person. I'm a reasonably smart person. I'm going to just read the Bible that is apparently everyone thinks is the greatest book of all time, and I'm just going to read it. Like, I'm going to see what it says. And I get that there's definitely – I will give that there's room – that there's definitely room for, you know, maybe this translation is bad and you need to know that, or maybe you need to – you would need to research to find some different historical context for certain stuff. But for the most part, why can't I trust that God's perfect book would be written at least in a form where I could read it and just accept the message? Like, I'm not trying – you might disagree, but I'm not trying to misinterpret anything. Like, I'm just reading the book.
Right. So, I think as we go through this, I have some examples.
Sure, that'd be great.
I think I'm going to throw or at least I'm going to try to throw kind of a big monkey wrench into that.
All right.
Because I think there's a couple of assumptions in there, and I wasn't targeting it as you. I mean, obviously, I wouldn't recommend this podcast if I thought you were a fundamentalist. I've been pretty critical of kind of atheistic fundamentalism, just like and anyone who knows me knows I'm pretty critical of Christian fundamentalism as well. So
fair enough.
But I think a couple of things you said kind of stood out, and what I wanted to address is you said, like, you just want to know what it, you know, you're not trying to misrepresent what it means, right? You're just trying to read it and understand what it means. Well, that's kind of the problem is when we understand what a text means. I should bracket off and say for now, in order to kind of charitably follow what I'm trying to say, we have to kind of just assume something like deconstructionalism is false.
Can you explain that?
I don't know. We have to kind of assume that there is a meaning to a text, that it's not just all reader response.
You are in good company here because I think that we, for the most part, can discover author's intent. I do. Yeah. I'm not going to try to throw that at you.
Okay. Yeah. I get into some conversations.
I know.
And that
it's
comes
frustrating.
Up and it's just,
I'm totally with you. I think we very much can. I think what people, sorry, I got to go off on a slight tangent because a long time ago, I did an episode on The Road Less Traveled, which was a weird thing, but it just was something I learned that the poem is completely different than what people mean or what people think it means. And I had someone send me like this essay from, I don't know, you might even know it. It was like the groundbreaking essay that made people stop looking for the author's intent. And when I read it, what I discovered was they were actually saying you can't judge, like if you're trying to judge a poem or judge a work on like how good it is, they're saying you can't take what the author intended and see like did they meet what they were trying to do, because you might not have access to that information. And that's a very different thing than saying, can I figure out what I think the author intended in the meaning of what they're writing? And right. I think that actually is a very different thing. And I haven't done much more research into it, but I'd be curious to see if that distinction is accounted for somewhere in the, you know, because I know that's a very popular, that might be the predominant view in literature or liberal studies or something, liberal arts. Yeah. And it's frustrating. I don't think it's true. I think we can very, I mean, we're all humans and we, when you, I think the thing, and again, sorry to just branch off on this. I think that's the thing people don't get is when humans write something, it's not just some random, there might be some art form where they just write random words that come to their mind, but it's not. Right. I mean, in order to even write something, you have to have an intention and you have to have a line of thought that you are exploring. And maybe it's not 100% clear, but I really think we can try to get close, you know, reasonably close. So, but anyway, I'll let you go on.
Oh yeah. So I was gonna say, I mean, I think there's a certain point where we have to say, well, you know, what if we just come to a text, especially when we get to ancient texts in different languages, and we try to just understand, you know, the clear and plain meaning, there's a certain level where we're going to say, well, there is kind of plain and clear meanings that we can understand, but there's going to be a lot of things that we misunderstand. And I'll get into some examples here in a bit, so you see that as you go. So, okay, the other thing that I think is kind of broadly misunderstood is that there's this false dichotomy, and you kind of you mentioned it. I don't know if you hold it as such a strong false dichotomy because I haven't asked you, but it tends to be a pretty strong view that it's something is either literal or it's allegory or it's metaphor, right? That it's either or one of those things, and I think that that's kind of that's also really misleading, and that's not the way that language works.
I think it really depends on how far you're breaking it down. I mean, are you talking about a given sentence? Are you talking about a given clause? Or are you talking about a given work? Because obviously,
either
a given Well, I don't know. I mean, a given you can going back to being able to evaluate someone's meaning. I mean, when I read, and just getting into hypothetical examples, when I read, someone says, "Well, I'm not a very by the way, I'm more a math person, so I may have trouble coming up with a good language example." But when I read something that says, "I threw that rock like it was a asteroid going into outer space or something," I understand that they don't literally mean they threw it like an asteroid, you know, they threw an asteroid or they cut it, but they literally meant they threw a rock. You know, there is a literal meaning in it. Like they're trying to say Correct. Something. They're using a metaphor or a simile. I can never remember the difference. I think simile is as, right?
Yeah. Simile has like or as. Metaphor is statement that something is something.
Oh, okay. So it is. Then it would be a simile, I guess.
Yeah.
So they're using the simile to paint the picture a little bit and I understand that, but I would say without a doubt, of course, a given work, a given book or you can't say that's is literal or is figurative because that's just way too broad. I mean, you could have vast stretches of either. But I do think that when you break it down to the kind of the narrative that you're following, you can say, well, this part is literal and this part is metaphor. I believe, and you can do your best. Maybe you'll be wrong some of the time, but I do think you can do your best to determine that.
Right. Well, I think part of the problem, so I gave the example of if I went to a concert and I told you the whole town was there, right? And you, if you're going to be like, Tyler's a damned liar, like not, the whole town wasn't there. I wasn't there and I live in town, right? There's a certain point where we say, well, you know, I'm not giving a metaphor. I'm not trying to teach some moral metaphorical truth. I'm saying as no, a concert, it's really crowded.
Painting a picture though. Yeah.
Yeah.
You're emphasizing your point by exaggerating.
Right. And so I think a lot of that happens in literature. And when I talk with a lot of fundamentalists, you know, atheist or Christian, this point is lost on a lot of them. I mean, I went to Moody Bible, right? Moody, the name you can trust, right? I went to Moody Bible, and Moody Bible, and I'm always the odd kind of duck out because I'm not a fundamentalist. I'm not, you know.
I've heard the name Moody Bible, but I don't really know what that means when you say you went there. Is that a school or something?
Moody Bible, yeah. It's a Bible Institute in Chicago.
Oh, okay. Is it typically fundamentalist or not?
It's pretty conservative.
All right.
Verges on the fundamentalist. You're gonna have some people there that are fundamentalists, some that aren't.
Okay.
It's very dispensational. I'm very reformed. If you know the difference between those two things, I was the odd man out on campus on a lot of things.
Yeah. You explain.
Anyone listening, they'll know that I was the odd duck out.
I don't know that anyone will know that. Why don't you go ahead and explain the difference between dispensational and reformation?
I'm not sure we have the time.
Okay. You can't give a brief.
Reformed theology tends to be Calvinistic, tends to view the covenants as one unified thing throughout the Bible. Dispensationalism is think of Left Behind, and that's dispensationalism.
Okay,
it's reading prophecy a lot of times as exclusively about end times things that you're reading in a newspaper. The locusts are helicopters, literal hermeneutic, right? When you're reading those types of things, I'm not that at all. And so I had a lot of these conversations at Moody as well. And so there's you know. It comes up a lot when you're talking about the differences between young earth creationism and old earth creationism. So how do you read Genesis 1? You know, and I think a lot of times it's cast as, well, it's either literal history, and by that they mean young earth creationism, or it's, you know, allegory, it's symbolism, all this kind of stuff. And I think that there's lots of positions in between where you don't have this really hard dichotomy between the two.
Well, okay, we talked a lot about intention. I would just like to ask you, because I've gone back and forth on this. It may surprise you to hear. I've had times where I've thought, well, the people who are writing this must have believed it was real. I mean, in their intention. And then other times I've thought, I don't know. I mean, I've seen quotes about a certain early church. I wouldn't be able to name them because I'm not very good at that. But certain early church writers, early church leaders who wrote like, well, it's obviously a metaphor very early on. So
Augustine,
I don't know.
Augustine is one of the most common examples given he read it as entirely.
So I go back and I really could be persuaded either way, but I want to ask you, in your opinion, let's take the example of Genesis 1. Mm-hmm. And by that, are we confining it to the first version of the story? Does it matter? There's like two different versions in there for some reason.
Yeah, I would disagree with that. It's two versions, but,
Okay.
Yeah,
well,
why
are there differences in how they describe it? I mean, like so, contradictions.
This actually is a hermeneutical issue.
Okay.
So when you're reading through Hebrew literature from the time, Hebrew literature was very stylized in some ways and very not stylized in other ways. And one of the things that it did is it worked under couplets. So you know when you read Proverbs and it says like one thing and then it reiterates the exact same thing in a different way? That's a couplet. It doesn't just do it in these little couplet of verses. It actually, there's narrative couplets where it'll retell the story from a different angle or for a different theme or for a different, you know, it happens kind of throughout different passages. And I think that's kind of what you have going on in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2. When I read Genesis 1, I'm inclined to agree with scholars like Meredith Klein, who see it as it's a really stylized literary framework. If anyone who's ever read Meredith Klein, he has a book called The Kingdom Prologue where he develops this out. But you can see kind of the literary framework that happens. So it's not necessarily that the authors are trying to give us, they're not trying to answer our modern scientific questions about cosmology. It would be, it actually, so John Walton has a lecture called Reading Genesis Through Ancient Eyes, which I recommend to every single person. If you have an hour, if you're interested at all in these topics, listen through his lecture. He shows that under the ancient worldview, the type of questions we ask would almost be impossible for the ancient world to even conceptualize. They just didn't have a lot of the same kind of cognitive hooks that we have to hang concepts on. They asked different questions. They thought about ontology different than we think. So when we think of ontology, if I talk about, for example, the formation of the solar system, right? If you and I were talking
about— I
know
this example already.
Yeah. You and I are going to think about how it actually comes into existence physically.
Yeah.
Right? They're going to think about everything functionally. So whether it existed before or not is irrelevant to them. It comes into being when it has a function for humanity. So that's their worldview.
Well,
that's
not only that, back
things.
In the day, people used to say they didn't have the equipment to question like why or how. They would just question like, well, why are there 9 planets? Whose idea was that, and what were they thinking? You know, like right. They thought there was some explanation for it. Like if you put a bunch of shapes into one another in a certain way, then you'd understand why there were 9 planets. And I do grant that definitely they thought of things a lot differently. So yeah. Go on. Sorry to interrupt.
And so I think that when you're reading through these passages, you know, reading and understanding the literature of it, this is where it gets tricky. Are they accurate descriptions of history? Right. This is where it gets tricky. So
it's pretty not tricky. It's just not accurate.
Well, it kind of is. So because in the ancient world, you could tell things in a different way for theological reasons. So you could change the order of events. You could change who is speaking in events. And it was all – the problem is that we're trying to understand it from a modern historiographical
perspective. Well, that's convenient that they're able to do that. I wonder why do they get to get away with that?
Because they were pre-Enlightenment. I mean they didn't have the benefit of living, you know, post-Enlightenment, where we start talking about objectivity and we start talking about making
at
sure
what
that
point,
you know,
if you're giving them all these licenses, at what point will it become indecipherable? I mean, I don't know. I mean, if
right.
you're going to
so,
say at a certain point they could have meant anything, anyone could have said this, anyone could have done that, it doesn't mean necessarily. At a certain point, it will lose all meaning, despite
well,
what you were saying
so,
before.
So it's not that there's no form. So remember, Hebrew literature is very stylized. So it's not that there's no form. It's not that there's no structure. It's not that there's no meaning. It's just that they didn't have ours. So I'm not actually giving them leeway or license. It's just historically that's how they did it. So I'm not looking back and saying, oh, you know, it's okay because, you know, that I'll allow it. We just understand how they did history back then, how they did literature back then. I mean, so you asked me about Genesis 1. So that's, you know, a really broad, pretty
well,
unsatisfactory
let me ask
answer,
you
I'm sure.
More,
but there's
no,
some resources.
I got to ask you some more detail. So we've been talking about the fact that we think we can gather an author's intention. You've said that you think a work or even a sentence in some cases can be both, or meaning can be both literal and figurative. So let's talk about Genesis 1. I could be persuaded that it's figurative language, but I want to know what you think the author thought. First off, was the author talking to God? Did God tell them to write this? Secondly, what did the author have in mind? What was their intention? If you wanted to say that it's literal, it's very easy. I think you can very easily say, well, their intention was they believed for whatever reason that this was the history of the world. They've maybe through their culture, through I don't know, who knows how many generations, somehow this story evolved and that's what they believe. That's not unheard of. I mean, there's lots of stories right. for how the earth came to be. So for me, that was always my approach. It's always this is pretty easy. These people thought this. They wrote it down. And conveniently enough for an atheist, that makes it very easy to say, well, they were wrong, so therefore they weren't talking to God and the Bible is not biblically inspired. And I think that maybe Augustine or other early church leaders, their reaction of this is not literal could have less to do with what the actual authors of Genesis intended and more to do with being able to maintain the authenticity of the Bible.
Probably not, because remember, just historically, Augustine wasn't trying to handle objections based on evolution, right? I mean, it just that would be entirely anachronistic. So yeah, he's not trying to reconcile it to kind of a scientific view of the world.
Do you not think that he could have? So you don't think he was at all? Yeah, that's a good point. So you don't think he was at all worried that that account was false? But then,
I think when he read through it, he read it as a piece of Hebrew literature, and he understood that it was literature, and it was kind of. And remember, Augustine is also pre-Enlightenment, so he had no problem reading it and seeing. Well, you know, they might not have meant this in an entirely.
What was the author's intention, and what in the world are we to get out of this?
So let me back up. So I'm gonna answer your question, but it's gonna be kind of a long way to get there.
That's fair.
Okay, so let's imagine that we found a piece of World War I literature. Do you think that the first important thing we can find out is what type of literature is it? Like, what genre is it that we're talking about? Is it is it a letter? Is it a poem? Is it a reporter writing down the historic, like the order of events? Right. So.
I'm with you. That sounds very important. Yeah.
Yeah. So genre is one of the first things we do. So if you picked up a piece of paper and it said, you know, Dear Thomas, what are you reading?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you'd need more than that, but I could assume you're reading a letter.
Right. So if you pick it up and it says, Once Upon a Time, what are you probably reading?
The dictionary. No. yeah. I don't know. A story.
Some type of fairy tale, right? Once upon a time, right? We have these structures in place that we instantly pick up as different
Understood.
Types of genres. Ancient literature had the same thing. So you have similar structures where a certain genre has certain characteristics, and the type of genre that an author chooses to use is going to be telling of what their intent is. So when Paul wasn't writing a gospel, he was writing epistles, right? Because he had different intentions than if he was trying to write a gospel. If you're reading through a poem as opposed to a narrative, you're going to use different idioms, right? Poems tend to be more, much more illustrations, much more imagery, right? They tend to say something that could be said very briefly in prose. They say it in very long ways. So the genre is going to determine how you tell something too. And then who's writing it. So if you have, you know, in this World War I literature, it's going to make a difference if it's, say, a soldier who's writing in a trench during the height of trench warfare during World War I, as opposed to, say, a general who's 4 miles back, right? Who has a more 360 view, who's trying to still do some of the politics of the time. It's also going to be very different if it's going to be maybe not even general, maybe it's the supply lines, right? So you have a supply clerk and we're reading through his records of what shipments were going where, and that can kind of tell us how the war was going on different fronts. So not only the genre, the types of literature that we're reading, but who's writing it, at what point in the war. So it's going to be important to know, you know, is this trench warfare, you know, in 1910, or is this trench warfare in 1915, right? Those are going to be major differences for us. So understanding a lot of that literary and historical context is going to be important, but then also understanding, well, it's probably, let's say this wasn't, you know, an American soldier, this is a German soldier. So we have the other problem of now we're dealing with the text that's in German. Right?
I think we can say your point is made. I understand all this.
Right?
for the sake of time.
Well, I'm laying on thick for kind of a reason. I mean, there's...
Because you're writing a poem, so you're taking forever to...
I'm writing a poem. I'm laying it out.
You're taking forever to say something that you could have said in press. No, go ahead.
So a lot of times... So just saying, I can't just pick up this piece of literature, or maybe an anthology. Maybe it's a collection of all of these, and say, well, I'm just going to read it just to get the meaning, right? I mean, even if I'm fluent in German, I can't say, well, I'm just going to ignore the history. I'm just going to pick it up and read it, right? Do you kind of see how that would become problematic?
Sure. Now, can you? Now I'm really curious. So, what do I do with Genesis? What is the point of it?
We'll get there.
Okay.
We'll get there. So when we're reading a text, we have to understand all these background points. Right. And then we also would want to understand.
Hold on. I want to throw one slight caveat that that when we're reading something that's supposedly the inspired word of God that should direct us and should tell us what to do, I would assume that God would have made it a little easier for us. That would be one assumption I would make.
That's an assumption. You said it right. You said it right. It's an assumption.
Yeah, it is. It's an assumption that I would make under the bigger assumption that God is real and this is his book. Of course, if he's not real and it's not his book, I 100% agree with you. It's just if it's just humans writing crap, then sure. But I think that might be part of it that I'm putting into it that maybe I didn't say before. I'm assuming – I think I said it. I mean, I'm assuming this was written by the smartest being in the world with the intent that I'm going to be able to read it and receive his message.
Right. So that's an assumption you and I wouldn't share. That's an assumption that actually the modern church wouldn't share with most of the historical church. When we're talking about inspiration has never been viewed as God just dictating scripture. It's never been, you know, while we talk about God's word, it's always been through human authors for purposes. And while the church has always affirmed what's called the perspicuity or the clarity of scripture, the clarity of scripture is the over. So when you're reading through the Bible, right, even in yours, I mean, do you have a hard time picking out, say what the historical trajectory of the narrative is, right? Do you have a hard time telling what the story, what the flow, the plot of the narrative is?
Sometimes. I don't know. It's pretty sometimes it's clear.
Sometimes if you don't know the history, maybe.
Yeah.
But overall, the story itself of the Bible is not that hard to figure out, right? God is creator. Humanity is in covenant with God. We fell, we sinned. God is now in the process of redeeming us, and in the end, it'll all work out, right? I mean, that's very broad brushes, but the story itself, the narrative itself, is not hard to understand.
It would not become clear until about 77% through reading it. By the way, though, none of that is clear in the Old Testament, which is most of the Bible. So it is a little weird that you have to read all this stuff that has seemingly not really much purpose, and then all of a sudden in the New Testament, someone's telling you that he's, you know, the storyline you just mentioned. So that part's a little weird, but I guess.
Well, that would be like saying that it's a problem for a novel because you don't know how it's going to end until you get to the end.
I don't think so, because the Old Testament has a lot of teaching and stuff that you should be following. Like, and the New, I mean, they're Jews just follow the Old Testament. As far as they're concerned, that's the storyline. Right. So it's a little weird. I mean, I guess I would just have to assume that Christianity is true in order to say, yes, you need to read the whole thing and it has to be consistent through the whole thing. But I guess that's an assumption you can make if you're assuming that Jesus is real and that's, you know, part of the – but I don't know that that's necessarily an assumption we would share.
I think we would if I pushed you a little bit further.
I would assume that Christianity is real. I don't
think no, and I don't think that I'm actually assuming that Christianity is true to know the basic plot line.
Well, but it would change. I mean, if you're saying the basic plot line under Judaism, it's totally different, despite the fact that most of the book is the Old Testament.
Well, I actually don't think it is. So I mean, right now I'm in the process of teaching through the Old Testament to my adult Sunday school class. So I'm teaching through the entire Old Testament. You could come to the class if you want to.
I don't want to ever read it. The Old Testament is the worst thing I've ever read in my life, so yeah. I'd rather not have to read it again. Granted, yeah. I haven't read 50 Shades of Grey or the vampire books that everyone's read, so it could be, you know.
And that, see, that to me is kind of indicative. So if you've read something that, you know, atheists and Christians alike have considered one of the best masterpieces of literature. If you read it and you say that's the worst thing,
is this 50 Shades of Grey we're talking about?
yeah, 50 Shades of Grey. Somewhere the track is probably derailed.
I don't think that. I think that that's a meme that some atheists have attached onto because they haven't actually read the Bible, and they like to give that as kind of an olive branch to Christians. Sometimes they like to say, "Well, look, we can all acknowledge it's a great piece of art and all that," and it really just isn't. I mean, it's my opinion, of course, but I read through the whole thing. I'm not, even if I thought it was true, like even if I was a Christian, it's horribly written. Like, it's just awful. I could say the Pentateuch maybe, not even that. Genesis, some of Genesis is okay. The part where I'm reading instructions on how to build an ark for hours of my life. It's meaningless. I'm reading the most repetitive thing. It repeats the same stupid messages over and over. The entire Old Testament is, Jews, don't do this. Oh, we did that. I'm punishing you. Never do it again. Over and over and over and over and over. And it's not even done interestingly.
Yeah, and see, this is why my criticism of your show is here. Because I think everything you just said is due to a lack of good hermeneutics.
All right, well, you're going to have to tune in Thursday to find out whether or not what Tyler just said is true. And there's lots more to come. So thank you so much for joining me. I want to thank especially patrons for sticking with it through that horrible ordeal. And I want to say I'm looking forward to Thursday for part 2 with Tyler Vella. So I will see you guys then.